No matter where you are, it's 2020, and this hour we're taking a look at what the new year may have in store for the Lone Star State on a special edition of the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Thanks for joining us, and Happy New Year to you and yours. Texas's first international allies have a saying, plus ça change, plus c'est le même. The more things change, the more they stay the same. And though issues like immigration, natural resources, and politics may sound par for the course, 2020 looks to be a banner year for change on those fronts and more here in Texas. We'll explore as our special edition of the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this first day of a new decade, though recently there's been much debate about the precision of such a statement. For some, the new decade doesn't start until January 1st, 2021, though most scholars say there's no authority on when a 10-year period on a calendar actually ends or begins. Not ones to dawdle, let's get on with considering a more substantive and relevant question. What will 2020 bring? Unfortunately, our crystal ball gets very poor reception here in the studios of the Texas Standard, but if ever there were a way to make educated and informed forecasts of the coming year in Texas, or at least give us a heads up when it comes to what to look for, well, this panel would have to be counted as most likely to succeed. Lauren McGaughey is investigative reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Hello there, Lauren.
Hey, how are you?
I am fine. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Brandon Roddinghouse, professor, and Pauline Yelderman, endowed chair of political science at the University of Houston. Happy New Year, Brandon.
You too, David.
And Happy New Year to you, Victoria DeFrancesco Soto, director of civic engagement and lecturer at the LBJ School at UT Austin. Good to see you.
Good to see you. I've been polishing my crystal ball for you.
Oh, good. That makes one of us. All right. So we are about to look at 2020. Yesterday, listeners who missed us, didn't get a chance to hear our look back at 2019. You can always go to texasstandard.org for that. But right now, we are going to look at what I think has been one of the biggest stories, at least in the run-up to New Year's Day. And you know the one I'm talking about, right? Impeachment. Anyone start to talk if you think impeachment is going to be moving the needles here.
I think a little. I mean, it'll definitely show that Republicans are slightly less unified than Democrats. Democrats definitely are in favor of impeachments. Republicans against impeachment, but certainly they have not as strong an opinion. I think it reflects the fact that you've got Donald Trump's numbers, which are pretty, I think, mediocre here in a state that typically Republicans win. The other issue is about undecideds who are not really attentive to the issue, and although they support it broadly, aren't really sure how to perceive this. So unless the impeachment discussion and unless the actual trial produces new information and has a kind of sizzle factor, I think it's not going to have a tremendous effect, but it's definitely going to keep on peeling kind of moderates and leaning Republicans away from the Republican Party and possibly towards the Democratic Party.
Did I hear you say trial, Brandon? I mean, do you think that's really going to happen in the Senate?
I think it will eventually in some way. And even if it doesn't, it's still all just out there in the ether. And it's part of the discussion of 2020.
You know, Lauren, there's been so much conversation, however, of what it will take if there is something that will turn Texas blue in 2020, right? This is a cliche, isn't it? I mean, if you talk with people in Texas politics and national politics, people are like, yeah, I believe it when I see it. But there are reasons to believe that there are important dynamics in play that could make 2020 could be a year that could be historic for Texas politics.
Well, we're definitely keeping our eye on certain things, but I think that Texas reporters on the ground like to remind sometimes the national media that this isn't like flipping a coin. You know, even asking the question is fraught. You know, a lot of the change is down to demographics that have been changing over the last decade, and those change very slowly. And every once in a while, you see some things that seem like a bellwether. So this year we might see some of that, but it's not going to be just a red to blue kind of shift. It's not going to happen. The bellwether we're obviously looking at is the Texas House of Representatives. It has been solidly red for a couple of decades, mm-hmm. and it has a chance to flip blue and to become Democrat held for the first time in a long time. And that means that for the first time, we'd actually maybe see some real fights between the two parties in the Texas legislature. And the Democrats have a real voice on some of the issues that they want to bring. Now they have to get 9 seats for that. So it's no small ask, no small lift, but that's what a lot of people have their eye on. If they can get the Texas House of Representatives, they get that chamber and they get a real voice in the redistricting process in 2020.
Yeah, you know, I think the race that a lot of people thought would be watched nationwide was John Cornyn's attempt to hang on to his seat in the Senate. Now, I know that the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee has picked MJ Hagar from among a large field of Democratic challengers to Cornyn. But Brandon, what do you think? You think that Cornyn's in any real trouble here?
I think he is. I think he's probably the least well-defined Republican Senate candidate for a very long time. There are still Republicans who aren't sure that they have a good sense of, you know, who he is and what he's done. So he's going to have to remind them. But of course, he does so with the competition of a bunch of Democrats who are going to challenge him. So I do think he's vulnerable. And I do think that if the right candidate emerges, then it could be a very competitive race. The DSCC seems to think that that's MJ Hagar, but everybody else disagrees. And I have to say, putting their finger on the scale like this is probably going to relate to, you know, more long-term problems, because the party's going to have to figure out if it wants a more moderate approach or a more like progressive approach. The candidates who didn't get the nod from the DSCC are saying that they represent the kind of new Texas, right? You had a 500% increase in the youth vote in by 2022, 1 out of 3 voters in Texas will be under 30. You had a expansion of the Latino vote to 26% turnout in 2018. So there is a tremendous amount of energy out there from young and ethnically and racially diverse Texans. And the folks like Senator West and like Chris Bell and like Christina Susun Ramirez are saying, you need to pay attention to this because this is where Texas is going.
Yeah, well, young ethnically diverse Texans, I think that may be part of the issue with the selection of MJ Hagar, because as you look at the field of candidates, Democrats in Texas, I don't know. I think that questions have been raised about ethnic diversity and who's getting sort of picked to be the front runner in several of these elections. Anyone want to weigh in here?
Yeah, I think the problem for Democrats, the Democratic field that is running against John Cornyn, is twofold right now. Number one, they have a lot of people in there. MJ Hagar might have gotten the nod, but, you know, a dozen people is a lot. And voters in recent polls don't know who any of them are very well. Not one of them has really, really floated to the top. Now, maybe this nod for MJ Hagar will boost her, but we haven't seen that yet. And Beto O'Rourke, who really caught a lot of attention when he ran against Ted Cruz, isn't going to endorse anyone. And so no one will actually have that upswing. The other side of the coin, the problem, I think, is that John Cornyn isn't Ted Cruz.
Oh, you stole my line.
Sorry. Would you like to? I'll baton.
I'm just going to say amen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, John Cornyn he's just not Ted Cruz. And there are people that will argue that Beto's success was maybe partially off of his personality and his youth, and also off of the fact that people just, you know, it was a clothespin vote against Ted Cruz. So,
yeah.
I think the only thing I would add to that is that not only is he not disliked like Ted Cruz, mm-hmm. A friend of mine described Ted Cruz as a big old bag of snakes. So wow. Aside from that, he has a lot of favors to call in, meaning John Cornyn, because Ted Cruz, love him or hate him, he isn't all that productive when it comes to lawmaking and legislating. He does a lot of the grandstanding, but he's not carrying the weight in terms of meeting with the business interests and meeting with diverse constituents and hearing them and doing what needs to be done. And John Cornyn has been doing that. So he's been carrying the weight for 2 senators on one set of shoulders. So there's also a lot of favors that he's going to be able to call in.
I'm going to just throw something out here. Maybe this is a wishful thinking, I don't know. But getting back to the crystal ball here, I believe that we are going to find out in 2020 what Texas really looks like. That is, assuming that the census does its job, right? But Texas is not making it terrifically easy. They're not putting a lot of money into this. There are a lot of grassroots groups that are, however. What do you think? And how could that census change things for us?
Depending on the outcome, each side is going to question the results. You know, if we think we see, people of color underrepresented in the sample. People are going to blame, you know, fears over citizenship questions and that kind of thing. If people think that they're overrepresented, they're going to say, oh, you know, they came out in droves to kind of flip the numbers or whatever. So it really comes down to what we see. I would like to see as well of a census as we can see mm-hmm. in that we're going into a redistricting year where
the maps could be redone.
The maps are going to be redrawn. And yeah. this isn't just for the Texas House and Senate. This is congressional maps. And so this is a big, big
it's
deal.
A ton at stake. Well,
yeah. And the money.
Yes.
So it's the districting, but it's also how we allocate federal money exactly. for dozens of programs that affect us day to day. And so what is so frustrating to me when we see the census used as a political football is that it doesn't matter what party you are, we're all using the same resources. So I'm usually an optimist, but I'm very pessimistic about what the census response rate is going to be. I think that over the last couple of years, there's been a fear that has been sown in to answering the census among immigrant communities, among communities of color, and I'm just plain worried. Aside from the fact that certain states aren't putting that much money in to mobilize, I think there's a generalized fear that's going to dampen the effect of the census.
And if I can just plug myself for a quick second. The Tribune first uncovered this, and then we kind of took an extra step with it. There was a bill passed in the 2019 legislative session that basically put all legislative communications into a black box. It totally closed them off. It's up to the lawmaker now to determine whether they think their communications on an issue are subject to public disclosure. Hmm. And when I asked the author about it, he made it very clear that this was done in advance of the redistricting effort. Because the last time the maps were redrawn in Texas, they went to court and they used private emails that showed that they were drawn along racial lines to redraw them. Now, they won't have access to those emails, most likely, or it'll be much more difficult to get them because of the change in the law. And so whatever happens behind the scenes, it's going to be a lot more difficult to know why decisions were made on those maps.
I wish we had more time to chat because we've just scratched the surface, obviously. Lauren McGaughey, investigative reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Brandon Rottinghouse, professor of political science at the University of Houston. Victoria DeFrancesco Soto, director of civic engagement and lecturer at LBJ School at UT Austin. Folks, thanks so much for stopping by, and a happy new year, come what may, here in Texas. Good to talk with you.
Thanks, David.
Happy New Year.
We're spending this hour looking at some of the top issues Texas will be facing in 2020. Our special New Year's broadcast continues in just a moment. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. On this New Year's Day, we're looking ahead to 2020. Just over 11 months till the next presidential election. That doesn't leave a lot of time to address lingering concerns about election security. Concerns that have been with us at least since revelations first surfaced about Russian efforts to interfere with the last presidential election cycle. What are Texans doing about it? Andrew Schneider of Houston Public Media reports from the Lone Star State's most populous city.
Our elections are only as valid as people think that they are.
John Oldham has been election administrator for Fort Bend County for more than 11 years, serving under both Republican and Democratic leaders.
Our country exists under a social contract, and every time we go to the polls to vote for people or on propositions, we ratify that contract again and again. And so long as people believe elections are secure, you know, that's just as important as making them secure.
Oldham says that's a big reason that Fort Bend County has switched over from purely electronic voting to a hybrid system involving paper backups, because he says that's what residents say they want. Fort Bend County is ahead of Harris County when it comes to upgrading voting machines. The Harris County Clerk's Office has just reached the point of getting permission from County Commissioners Court to start the bidding process for voting machine vendors. If commissioners give their permission, the process of selecting a vendor could take until May. Diane Troutman is the Democratic Harris County Clerk.
Once we choose the vendor, we'll have to place an order for these machines, and that will be about 8,000 machines. And an order that big, as you can imagine, will take some time to build and get to us. So that places us about early fall before we can actually receive them.
Trying to rush the new machines into service by November of next year could backfire in a big way. Without enough time to educate poll workers and voters on how the new machines work, lines at polling places could explode, discouraging many from sticking around to vote.
Our target date to use them first would be the May 2021 election, which is a much smaller election and a good place to start testing that equipment.
In the meantime, Troutman is focusing on the essentials. That includes making sure the existing machines work as intended. It means training all 333 county clerk staff members for cybersecurity, not just election staff and IT workers. And it means undergoing an internal audit of IT and election systems as required by the Texas Secretary of State. Lisa Mujica is election director for Republican-led Brazoria County, which has already been through the audit.
So we definitely are a step ahead of a lot of the counties out there.
Brazoria County just adopted new voting machines, an all-electronic system with no paper backup.
None of our equipment, the equipment that we use, Verity Touch, those voting booths are not connected to their internet whatsoever. So even when it comes into our office, it's not connected to the internet.
Dan Wallach manages Rice University's computer security lab. He says local governments are making the best of the hands they've been dealt.
Counties and states generally are operating with very limited funding for voting equipment. And what that means is it's a slow process for the counties to find the budget and to go through the budgetary process to replace old machines with newer ones.
In the end, Wallach says, election security largely comes down to public perception. If people assume their vote will be tampered with, they may not vote at all. Which is why one point all three election administrators make is that their success depends on educating the public and instilling trust that the system will work as it's supposed to. In Houston, I'm Andrew Schneider.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. So what was it Churchill once said about democracy, the worst form of government except for all the other forms of government we've tried? A less cynical and more theoretical perspective is that democracy is better than other methods of governing people because of its unique ability to put power in the hands of ordinary folk, assuming that our elections work, of course. And we have a very big one coming up later this year. A new book written by a native Texan suggests what could be done to make our elections better. Smarter Ballots, Electoral Realism and Reform is the title. The author, Jason Molloy, is a professor in political science at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Jason, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Ballots, of course, can look different from state to state. Texas recently did away with straight ticket voting. When we talk about electoral reform, or when you do, what are you thinking about? That sort of reform or something much larger?
Well, I focus in on the input rules that voters have to put their judgments into the process. So the very method by which you express a judgment about this or that candidate in a particular contest. We're so used to looking at a list of candidates for one seat and picking one. And what that means is 100% of your support as a voter goes to a single candidate and 0% of your support necessarily goes to all the others. But there are actually other forms of input rules that are used in some places around the world called distributive ballot types. And those allow you to give finer grain judgments and to actually express a view about more than just one candidate.
That's very interesting. So in other words, you might have three candidates on a list of candidates that you like. Could you rank them, perhaps? Maybe this is my first choice, here's my second, and here's my third?
Yeah, ranking ballots are the most common type of distributive input rule for voting systems. and they're used in Australia and Ireland, have been for 100 years, also in some American cities and counties. And there are three states that have a form of blanket primary. In other words, many people on an initial ballot with, it could be more than one Democrat, more than one Republican, more than one Independent, all on the same ballot.
You know, forgive me for jumping in here, Jason, but I'm thinking that you might have some recent electoral cycles in mind as you think about reform. Am I incorrect there?
No, I mean, one of the things that we saw in the 2016 presidential election, we saw at least three viable candidates on the Republican side and two candidates on the Democratic side. You had these five candidates who went right down to the wire, down into May and June. And what that reflected is that there's actual diversity within the two major parties. There aren't just two choices that voters want to see. They want to have more options. And the ranking system allows you to have those more options without the danger of vote splitting leading to a minority winner or a plurality winner.
Would this, in some measurable way, restore faith in the Democratic system?
The process would have to change in states like Maine and cities like Minneapolis and San Francisco that have used ranked choice voting appear to show a different kind of process where candidates have to adopt an attitude, a strategy in the campaigns where they're not just isolating their core supporters against the rest of the world, but they've got to reach out a little bit to try to win people's second and third preferences, because those second and third preferences could come down to deciding the outcome.
Do you think that, realistically speaking, that we could see these sorts of reforms? I can't imagine it happening by 2020, but in the not too distant future?
It's kind of popping up in different places around the country, so it's becoming more and more a viable reform.
Jason Malloy is a professor in political science at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. His new book is Smarter Ballots, Electoral Realism and Reform. What do you think of these ideas? Tweet us, won't you, at Texas Standard. Jason, so good to talk with you again. Thank you so much for speaking with us on The Standard.
Thanks, David. It was my pleasure.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a statewide network of physicians treating more than 50,000 new cancer patients each year with technology and cancer-fighting care options. More at texasoncology.com.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. As we spend this hour looking ahead to 2020, the day circled in red on most every Texan's calendar is November 3rd. That's a Tuesday. And there are a lot of reasons Democrats think that first Tuesday in November could be an historic one for their party. As the national arm of the Democratic Party targets Texas's rapidly growing and changing suburban districts, various voting groups could affect efforts to flip some reliably Republican seats. The Standard's own Jill Ament has been exploring how one group in particular may play an outsized role this time around, suburban Texas women.
Until 3 years ago, Ana Maria Ramos could be counted on to help her Richardson Neighborhood Association. A lifelong Democrat, Ramos was always ready to lend a hand in a local party effort. But she says Donald Trump's election 3 years ago pushed something inside her.
I actually was so furious that I ordered political yard signs that I made up myself. They were black and bold letters that said, "Resist Trump."
Ramos was certain there would be backlash from her suburban neighbors after she put one of the signs in her front lawn. Richardson is in solidly blue Dallas County, but portions of it lie in the historic Texas Republican stronghold of Collin County. But Ramos was surprised to find out that her signs acted like a beacon. More like-minded political newbies came to her door. And from there, in her suburban living room, a bigger local coalition was born.
And it was after that through our movement and our passion for just fighting for our neighbors, that it just became what I call now, it became a spiritual revolution.
For the past three decades, the neighborhoods near where Ramos lives have mostly been Republican. But recently, House District 102 has become a more competitive seat. The district includes Dallas County suburbs that have seen rapid overall growth and a much more diverse populace since 2009. That shift can make this district less of a GOP sure thing. And what's happening in North Texas is also happening in other growing suburbs across the state.
Certainly, we have seen in the past couple of election cycles, especially 2016, at the national level, a movement of predominantly white women who are married and with kids, who might have in the past supported a Republican candidate, uncomfortable with candidate Trump.
That's Rebecca Dean. She holds the political science chair at the University of Texas in Arlington. Dean says this trend was more visible in last year's elections in North Texas and across the state. She says women living in those suburbs are a key factor in this possible political shift.
So I guess you would say it was as about grassroots as you get.
Oh, absolutely. It was really grassroots. So
inside Ramos's living room, her fledgling political group started taking a closer look at their state lawmakers. As they learned more about their state rep's voting record, Ramos and her group felt even more unsettled.
So it was very anti-immigrant, anti-LGBTQ, and which is what we were resisting, right? And
that pushed Ramos, a lawyer and community college professor, to take a bigger political leap. Overnight, the living room where she had her activist meetings became her campaign headquarters.
I said, guys, I'm going to run for office. I don't really even know what this is all about, but I'm going to do it.
Last year, Ramos won her race against Republican incumbent Linda Koop by 5 percentage points. Ramos was heavily outfunded by Koop, but she credits her newfound political success to women living in her district.
I could not have won it without the support of the suburban women, the amazing moms and retired teachers in our community who gave their blood, sweat, and tears to help us flip the seat.
Some of the core voting issues for suburban women right now are education and health care, says Elizabeth Seamus, a political science professor at the University of Houston.
So in general, a lot of the issues that women on public opinion surveys would rank as their most important issues tend to be more of the bread and butter Democratic and liberal issues. Stereotypically, the things like education, healthcare, the social safety net.
And Seamus says as more college-educated, employed women choose the suburbs over living in the city for more affordable housing, they're bringing their political ideology with them.
I am a suburban mother. I am a suburban woman right now. But again, I think I'm also an example of that changing demographic. I'm educated. I'm employed. I'm not necessarily that 1950s housewife that just votes the way my husband tells me to.
UT Arlington's Rebecca Dean says historically, this group has leaned Republican.
We think of them as Chamber of Commerce Republicans, so fiscally conservative and socially more moderate. Not liberal, but perhaps more moderate.
So if suburban women seem to be shifting their vote from red to blue, what do Republican candidates do in 2020?
We, as the Republican Party, need to better connect with these women voters.
That's Randon Steinhauser. She's a Republican strategist based in Austin. She's sounding the alarm for her party.
I think more than anything, we've got to connect with the women at the local level and make sure that they understand that Republican policies are for supporting small businesses, supporting entrepreneurs, limited government, lower taxes, making sure that they understand our desire to have strong education opportunities for families.
Steinhauser says the Republican Party needs to field stronger women candidates in general.
Until we have strong conservative women candidates running for office that suburban women can identify with, that they can sit down and have a glass of wine with, or talk about the neighborhood school with, or understand the issues that affect suburban women, it's going to be very difficult. We cannot have the same old candidates running time and time again.
There are three Central Texas congressional districts held by Republicans being targeted by the Democratic Party in 2020. One of those races includes Republican Congressman John Carter's seat. Democratic candidate MJ Hagar came within 3 percentage points of unseating Carter. Hagar's now set her eyes on unseating longtime Texas U.S. Senator John Cornyn. UTA political science chair Rebecca Dean says off the bat, MJ Hagar's experience as a suburban mom and a military veteran appeals to women on both sides of the aisle.
So voters tend to assume liberalism among women more than they do among men, absent any other piece of information. And so her combat veteran background negates that.
But Elizabeth Seamus at the University of Houston says male candidates can still appeal to women voters in the suburbs. She points to Beto O'Rourke's failed but strong challenge to Senator Ted Cruz last year.
I think we saw O'Rourke do a good job of really inspiring and motivating and mobilizing women. So it definitely doesn't have to be a woman candidate, but I think women candidates are in a unique position to speak to women as, you know, somewhat an overlooked or forgotten group in the conversation.
Meanwhile, back in Richardson, Republican Linda Koop is gearing up for a rematch against Ramos in 2020. Koop's campaign did not respond to requests for an interview for this story, but Representative Ramos is expecting another tough race.
I know that it's highly probable that we will be outspent again, but at the end of the day, we won't be outworked, and that's where my focus is.
Reporting in Richardson, I'm Jill Ament for the Texas Standard.
There's a whole lot more of the Texas Standard coming up on this New Year's Day. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
You're listening to a special broadcast of the Texas Standard, looking ahead to some of the top issues facing Texas and Texans in 2020. Throughout 2019, Texas lawmakers were giving a lot of thought to something that could shake up politics in a big way, something set to happen this year. And in this case, we are not talking about a presidential contest. As KERA's Christopher Connolly reminds us, one might think of the upcoming census as another of those Texas versus California rivalries.
Texas lawmakers like to talk a lot about how Texas is different than California. But when it comes to preparing for the next census, Texas doesn't have much to brag about. California has dedicated $150 million to make sure Californians are counted in the once-a-decade census. Texas, so far, has put up nothing. And that concerns State Representative Cesar Blanco, an El Paso Democrat.
Texas is behind. And that's not a very Texan thing to say. But if we don't step up, the reality is California is going to eat our lunch. Our Texas dollars will be going to California and other states.
A quarter of Texans are considered difficult to count, and historically, the state's population has been undercounted, which means that Texas misses out on federal dollars to pay for public schools, highways, and health care. The Center for Public Policy Priorities says even a 1% undercount in 2020 could cost Texas hundreds of millions of dollars. Priscilla Camacho from the Dallas Regional Chamber of Commerce says a complete census is also important for business.
Data is used by and large every day, all day by businesses. When we make relocation decisions, when we talk about expanding in a location, we use data, and much of that data is census data.
The size of Texas's congressional delegation is also at stake, and advocates say fast-growing Texas could actually lose House seats if too many Texans go uncounted. In Dallas, I'm Christopher Connolly for the Texas Standard.
Now we're going to attempt to do something no other news program has ever tried before. We are going to give you news from the future. If you stare deeply into your radio speaker and put your fingers to your temples, I will try an incantation. This year, we shall undertake a national census. But wait, I can see further. This year, Texas will not pull out the stops to make sure that everyone gets counted.
Now, that last prognostication may or may not be entirely accurate, depending upon just how successful our next guest is. Celia Cole is chief executive officer of Feeding Texas. That group is one of the more than 120 nonprofits that have teamed up to create Texas Counts. Celia, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We know the challenges. Texas is not funding 2020 census outreach efforts. So what exactly is Texas Counts hoping to do to reach some of these hard-to-count areas?
Well, we are going to be providing lots of resources and expertise and technical assistance to nonprofits and other partners all over the state. And we're encouraging everyone to become a census champion and to join the Texas Counts campaign. And I can give specific information on how folks can do that, how they can sign up to join discussion forums. We're also encouraging nonprofits who serve hard-to-count areas in the state to apply for funding. There is still funding available. And then finally, we're urging people to donate to the Texas Counts campaign to ensure that Texas gets its fair share in the next decade.
What is this Counts Census Champion business about? What is that?
Well, if you go to texascounts.org, you can sign up to learn more, to join discussion forums. Ultimately, we want individual volunteers and organizations all over the state to have access to the experts and the resources that they need to promote the Texas Census. Again, individual organizations that want to do specific census promotion work can apply for funding. And then we're encouraging folks to donate to the campaign.
It is my understanding, and I suppose yours as well, that some 1,000 people have been migrating to Texas per day for the past some time now, and it's been now 10 years since the last comprehensive census in Texas. And I believe the last numbers I saw were somewhere in the order of, 27.8 million Texans? Is that close to what you
that
have heard?
That sounds right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, we talk about the numbers, and I think the concern here of an undercount and why we're out here doing this, and I'll start with the kids. I mean, one of the hardest to count populations is kids under five. So you're talking about, a decade, essentially a lost childhood for these kids if we don't count them. So this isn't something we can get wrong this year and make up for in the next year or two. This is a decade of condemning these kids to a lost childhood.
I want to stop you right there because I want to understand this. What does that mean, a lost childhood? I have heard something like if you miss 1% of the count in Texas, that could have a profound multi-billion dollar potential effect, right?
And in fact, we estimate for every 1% undercount, a potential cost of $3 billion over 10 years. And what that cost is coming from is in lost resources, lost funding for Texas in really some key areas that ensure that kids grow up healthy and ready to learn and can become productive citizens. And primarily, we're talking about health insurance programs like Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program. The amount of federal funding that comes to Texas for those programs is directly tied to our population, which is why an accurate count is so important. We're also talking about lost education funding, potentially less funding for subsidized housing. I mean, all of the supports that low-income kids need to thrive are at stake here. And so that's what we mean when we talk about a lost childhood.
But I think that a lot of folks think, well, the census is something that the government does. There's not a whole lot that lay Texans can, everyday folk can do to make sure everyone gets counted.
Well, I think that's not correct, and we hoped that hopefully being on this program and you guys bringing attention to this issue will sort of dispel that myth, because that's exactly why we have come together with other organizations and funding partners to put together the organization to get Texas Counts going, because it does provide opportunities and resources for individuals all over the state to become knowledgeable about the census, to get involved in promoting the census. We'll start out with obviously social media and regular media marketing, letting folks know how important it is to be counted and how they can be counted. And then we'll be doing some very specific things through our food bank network. And we rely on thousands of volunteers to do all the work we do to basically encourage the people we serve to be counted, to fill out the census when it comes to them. And then we'll be doing some really targeted follow-up with those folks that commit to be counted. So that's an opportunity for volunteers to engage and get involved. I mean, this is going to be labor-intensive work, and so we need every individual who cares about the future of Texas kids and really the future of Texas to sign up today at texascounts.org.
Celia Cole is Chief Executive Officer of Feeding Texas, one of the more than 120 nonprofits teaming up to create Texas Counts. Ms. Cole, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard, and Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you, too. It's great to be here.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard on this first day of 2020 as we explore some of the issues and trends facing the Lone Star State in the next 12 months. As many Republicans are now conceding, Texas isn't as reliably red as it once was. Congressman Henry Cuellar is one of the relatively few Texas Democrats who's enjoyed almost 15 years without much of a challenge until now, and we are not talking about a challenge from a Republican here, no. The group that helped progressive Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez score an upset in New York, the so-called Justice Democrats, has set its sights on Texas's 28th district, backing a bid by a 26-year-old political newcomer who's trying to topple her former boss in this November's elections. Texas Public Radio's Rinaldo Leaños Jr. reports.
Jessica Cisneros is making her way down a gravel driveway towards a wooden mint-colored house. She's in a colonia in Palmview in the Rio Grande Valley, a region along the border where about a third of the population lives in poverty. A woman approaches Cisneros and asks if she's the candidate, and she responds saying yes, she is. It's day two of the Cisneros campaign, and she wants to hear from locals about what some of their needs, wants, and concerns are in their neighborhoods. Cisneros continues to meet the other people, and they mingle for a while. Then they grab some chairs and form a circle. Margarita Suchil has lived in the area for about 20 years. She and the others present say they don't have health insurance and often have to go to Mexico to get treatment because it's more affordable. Suchil said that her doctor said that she needed to get a mammogram but didn't have the money to get it done. So they sent her to a clinic and the cheapest they could charge her was $70. Cisneros tells the women one of her platforms is ensuring Medicare for all. She also tells the group she can relate and that some of her own family members also don't have health insurance. Cisneros says she had an aunt who had stomach cancer and she died because she couldn't keep up with the treatment and couldn't pay for it. They continue their conversation for about an hour and a half and bring up other pressing issues like not having street lighting, sidewalks, or sometimes running water. Cisneros hears them out and promises to fight on their behalf.
You know, America is supposed to be one of the richest countries in the world, and yet here we have communities that have been isolated, that they don't have, you know, basic infrastructure, they don't have lighting, they don't have water, they don't have sewage.
Cisneros says one of the reasons she decided to run for Congress is because she wants South Texans to be proud of the representation they have in Congress. She was also a former intern for Cuellar back in 2014.
Never once did he ask me. He knew I was a constituent, and he never once did he ask me, what changes do you think we can bring to South Texas? And we've already talked to so many community members, and they say the same thing. I've never spoken to Henry Cuellar, and he's never asked me what we think we should, you know, change.
Cuellar was not available for an interview, but his campaign spokesperson, Colin Strother, was. He says when they heard Cisneros was running against Cuellar, they were caught off guard.
There's a big sense of betrayal that someone that we considered, you know, in our family and that we went to extraordinary length to help her further her ambitions and her career would turn around and not just run against him, but run against him by denigrating him and propagating falsehoods.
Cisneros has said the congressman voted in favor of the border wall within his own district. Strother says the congressman has been one of the loudest voices against the border wall. But in a 2019 appropriations bill, Guayad voted in favor of allocating more than $1 billion for border infrastructure, and in doing so helped prevent a government shutdown and also protected places like a historic chapel and the National Butterfly Center from getting border wall. Strother says they're currently working on a new spending bill that will claw back millions of dollars that were previously allocated for border infrastructure.
The congressman, because of his hard work, his reputation, and his years of experience, he gets to the table where decisions are made and he is able to influence things.
Dr. Henry Flores is a professor emeritus of political science at St. Mary's University in San Antonio. He says the congressman has a lot of institutional support and name recognition, but the conditions in the district might be ripe for a challenge.
The citizens and voters of the country don't like to see entrenched politicians hold on to power and hold on to power and hold on to power, particularly if their particular social and economic conditions don't change very much.
He says Cisneros' progressive agenda might help her during the election, especially since she's championing health care for all.
That's something that South Texas really, really needs, is real substantive health care reform. People have been calling for that for a long, long time, and there's only been marginal changes over the decades.
Flores says since Guayad is an incumbent, he has a lot of community connections that have helped him get elected throughout the years. So he already has a network in place. Flores says Cisneros will have to raise substantial amounts of money to take on the congressman and travel throughout the diverse and large district from the Valley to Laredo to San Antonio to get her name out there. Cisneros says she has no problem doing that because her campaign is about la gente, the people. In Palmview, I'm Reynaldo Leaños Jr.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Joining us for this first check of the social media landscape of 2020, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Yes,
so what
sir.
Are Texans talking about?
Well, Happy New Year, David.
And same to you.
Well, maybe not surprisingly, but with all this talk about the year ahead, prognostications are pouring in through the Texas Standard Facebook page. And perhaps unsurprisingly, what with this being a presidential election year, most of our friends and listeners are focused on that race for the White House. Peter Moore shares his predictions with us. He writes that Trump, not convicted by the Senate, wins re-election. The Republican Party splits, creating the biggest shift in American politics in a decade. I'm not quite sure if they would split in response to a presidential win, but stranger things have happened, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Randy Love says that 2020 will continue on with Trump growing more antagonistic each day than we vote, and Randy predicts that Trump will lose in a landslide. Look for a much better 2021, Randy writes. Meanwhile, Anthony Dallas Grossclose, he predicts that Trump won't win re-election due to burnout from the voters. And Keith Harris says, anything goes. It looks like there's no accountability. 2020 is going to be like the Wild West. Tom Smith Jones, well, echoes that prediction as well. He predicts much wailing and gnashing of teeth. However, Marcos R. Gonzalez, he predicts a year of clarity. I guess that's an interesting way to interpret events that are to come.
A year of clarity.
A year of clarity. And I suppose we could receive some clarity about the direction that this nation is going in with those presidential results and lots more on election day.
Why is it that I think that an election won't give us a whole lot more clarity in the United States? I don't know. It seems as if sometimes the morning after has proven to be to give us something somewhat less than clarity in the not too distant past.
This is true. Although I do think back to 2016 and just the shocking to many people turn of events, many people not predicting the Trump win there. And so I think everything that we've seen over the last four years could definitely
you can go way back to a former Texas governor, and you know there were weeks that we didn't know who the president was the morning after. So, I mean, who knows what could happen.
And, you know, I think that's something that people are all still keeping in mind there. Also via Facebook, Matthew Strawn says this about the whole idea of predictions. After this year, you've got to be kidding. Meanwhile, Daniel Alvarado goes on a slightly more hopeful note. He says, more money for our schools plus more jobs in 2020. Texas is the best of the West. God bless the world. Well, very nice sentiment there from one Daniel Alvarado.
I like the optimism.
And an optimistic note. Good one to go into the new year on, I would think.
Yes. Keep your predictions, your forecasts coming to us at Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice, of course. Wells Dunbar will be looking for you in the new year, and so will the rest of us. I'm David Brown on behalf of the entire Texas Standard crew, wishing you a wonderful 2020.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.